Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 180, Craftlit Meet Bard, Bard Meet Craftlit. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. You can find Knitting Out Loud at www.knittingoutloud.com and Knit Circus Magazine, the online magazine where you can find three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. Visit Knit Circus at www.knitcircus.com. Well, hello. It's good to be back with you. I am so sorry for those of you listening in real time. I had every intention of putting a podcast out last weekend, which was Labor Day weekend, and instead, my computer died because, you know, everything must happen all at once. One cannot have one thing in one's life go wrong. One must have many things in one's life go wrong. But we scrambled and we were able to find a replacement. And so that is what I am recording on today. I have no idea if this is going to sound any different. It doesn't sound any different in my ear, but I'm just hoping that the process goes more quickly, because on my old computer, which was admittedly 4 years old, or five, maybe four, maybe five, not sure, around there, it took a long time, a ridiculously long time, to save the podcast. So that's all good news. You know, in the end, after the insanity, it's all good. And with things that are all good, Interweave has Soccupied all released. There is a link to Soccupied, the place where you can purchase it. Please join with me in doing so, if you don't mind, because it's really cool. I am quite impressed with this particular product. I also got a really cool email from Phyllis. She was cracking me up, because there is a place called Snow Farm that is in Massachusetts? Maryland? Massachusetts, I think. And they're holding a knitting class, like a retreat kind of thing. And the very first line of the webpage that is giving the information on this class starts with Madame Defarge. So if you're in that area and interested, it's a beautiful website, and the picture that they have of their actual location is also gorgeous. Go take a look and let them know how cool you think it is that they're talking about Madame Defarge. And oh, by the way, there's a book of knitting patterns coming out. We're actually moving the release date back to February 7th. That is Charles Dickens' birthday. And that'll just keep me a little bit sane, what with all of the craziness that's about to happen in travels and things like that. So that's something. Also, I have links to, I don't do this very often, but I have links to one of those Letter to Congress websites, plus some background information sites. It turns out that there's all these studies that are being done. Young girls are maturing way faster, physically, way faster than they should be. It's quite disturbing. And, you know, it appears to be breaking down demographically kind of the way you would expect it to be breaking down. Kids who have less access to good nutrition are having these problems earlier and much more severely than kids who are eating more healthily. However, one of the things that has not been tested, which I remember we found out when I was pregnant, is toxins and toxin rates in children. So things may be approved for adult consumption, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're safe for children in, obviously, in the same amounts or, you know, in vitro safety. So there seems to be some kind of link. And Congress needs to get moving their rear end in the United States towards at least doing some studies to find out what the human body can tolerate. And of course, the reason why I'm concerned with this now is because I'm, after having done a bunch of research, I'm fairly convinced that I went this whole weird gluten thing, at least in part, because God only knows what we've been putting into my body. I eat relatively well, I like to think, but I don't buy organic all the time, and that's a lot of money. And, you know, you do the best you can, and you grow your own garden as much as you can, but that doesn't mean that this stuff isn't getting into milk and onto plants and into meat, and it's kind of spooky. And we just, I think we don't appear to have all the information that perhaps we need to have to make informed decisions. And I'm fairly comfortable saying that because we now have actual proof that girls aren't maturing, physically maturing at the age of 7. Which, you know, join me in a gasp of shock and horror. That's just not right. I don't care how fast you've grown. Getting curves when you are 7 is just kind of wrong. So anyway, there are links to 3 of the articles, the Congress, you know, Write Your Congressman website. And if you're interested, you know, it's not a hard sell. If you're interested, go take a look. And my son, who's been banging on me for days now, wants you to know that he has listed his Bakugans on eBay. And if you have children who are interested in purchasing Bakugans, he has put up on eBay a bunch of his most sought-after ones. He's very excited about this. So there are links to the Bakugans on the show notes, because I am a sucker for a mom. I was introduced to someone who you all should meet. Now, you've heard me talk about Julie at Forgotten Classics, and many of you listen to Forgotten Classics podcast, and good that you do. And Julie, as you know from Tale of Two Cities, Julie is the one who is responsible for me doing Tale of Two Cities, because I made some offhand comment about loathing the book in high school. So we know we can trust Julie, right? So Julie at Forgotten Classics told me that she had found a new podcast, a Shakespeare podcast. Mm-hmm. And I thought, ooh, well, that kind of sounds interesting. So I went and I found it, and the website looked awesome. Partially, I'm sure, due to the fact that the gentleman in question who records the podcast is a graphic artist, along with many other things, actor, teacher, all those things. So it's a fabulous website, and I thought, well, that's, you know, that bodes well. So then I downloaded and fell in love. It was one of those moments where, well, I'm sure we've all had this happen. It, you know, the first time it ever happened for me was Brenda Dane, and then kind of stretching out from listening to Cast On into other podcasts. When you find a good one, you know it. You know, someone who's paying attention and who's going to stick around and who's not going to leave you hanging at the end of things. Because it was one of the comments he made that he had been frustrated by some podcasts that he had really, you know, devoted himself to and gotten into and taken the time to get familiar with and all of that, only to find that they disappeared and died a tragic death not too long after that, and then you're left hanging. Like if they had ended Lost in the middle of season 2, that just would have really hurt. That kind of thing. So he's not that kind of person. He is gonna stick around. And he's gotten more and more regular in his recording timings. He's about every 2 weeks now. And well, instead of me yammering anymore, how about I let you listen to him for a moment? I started by asking Aaron Ziegler of Chop Bard Podcast where he got his information and his insight and his particular point of view.
A lot of it, I think, came from various sources, because I never really stayed in any one school of thought. I was always moving around and different teachers, most of whom always had really extremely different backgrounds themselves, which I liked. I think the most... The people who influenced me the most, I think, were the ones that made me look at Shakespeare completely differently. And because it was mostly through theater backgrounds, so there was Shakespeare was, it wasn't just nice words and images. It was always through acting and through objectives. So these were always looked at as people who needed something, who really had to have something. And I think one of the influences was a dramaturg named Michael Flockman, who I worked with at the Kern County. And he was my real first encounter with sort of the scholar type. Before, he'd been teachers, and he was this dramaturg. And they said, oh, we brought in this professional. He'd worked at Oregon Shakespeare and Utah Shakespeare. And so he had this big pedigree. And I was like, oh, okay, this big, you know, scholar. So we have to be all reverent. And he came in, and he was, you know, he looked like a scholar. And so I'm sitting down to take notes. And all of a sudden, he's talking about Romeo and Juliet in very street-like terms, and you know, he was saying, I remember my first encounter with him is he was talking about Juliet's monologue, "Come Night, Come Romeo." And some people were kind of giggling because they're like, "Oh, it sounds like she's dirty." And I thought, oh, you know, he's going to yell at him. And he said, "Now, you know, why are you laughing at that?" And they said, "Well, you know, and they were all embarrassed. And they said, "Well, it, you know, it kind of sounds dirty." He said, "Well, you know, she's a young 16-year-old girl. There's probably something to that." And we all just sort of looked at him. And here's the scholar. And he broke Romeo and Juliet down into really just basic human terms. And I think that really started me on a road of looking at it, that Shakespeare wrote for real people. And it was almost like, well, why didn't I see that before? And, you know, all this other stuff is bonus, all the beautiful language. And then I just, as I would listen to other teachers talk about it, I'd gravitate towards people who really picked up on that as well. And I was really lucky to attend the National Shakespeare Conservatory in New York, which is why I moved from West Coast to East Coast. And we just had some amazing people in that, from directors to Shakespeare people who just had such a life experience. And so I would sort of suck all that in, and it really influenced me. And but I always go back to, I think, working with that first production of Romeo and Juliet. I'd liked Shakespeare before that, but I remember working with this dramaturg and seeing just the base level of humanity, like the simplest. And I remember clearly I was in a gas station once getting gas and thinking about the play and trying to figure out who these people were. And I looked up and there was just like a group of teenagers hanging out in a parking lot. It was a hot summer day and they're just, you know, hanging out, pushing each other off of the cement walls and talking and joking with each other. And it was like a light went on in my head and I looked at them and I was like, well, that's the play right there. And I think ever since then, it like switches something in your head and you can't help but look at Shakespeare and you see through all the fancy words and you say, I see who you really are. And that the fancy words are just the depth of emotion that they're feeling. So it's, and now I love it. I love it when I find teachers and so-called experts who just have that passion. I could sit and listen to them for hours. So yeah, I think, yeah, it's been nice too, going over a lot of it. Cause some of it, you know, there's so much, you can forget some things and then going over it again, you have to remind yourself of certain rules and you're like, oh wow, wait, do I, and then some of the things they get so ingrained in your head, you just do them. But having to explain it again, it reminds me to look at it and relook at the lines. And then I'm always coming on contradictions. Like for a long time, I'd heard if you have single syllable words, that's permission to go faster because you can speak it faster. But then I've heard people say, no, when you have single syllables, that means you slow down and sort of enjoy them. And so that one I've seen it work both ways. Sometimes, because someone once told me that the Shakespeare will dictate the speed by the words that he's using. If he's using a lot of simple words, you can say it faster. But if he's using a lot of complex words, he forces you to slow down. But then I've also heard they said, well, when you have these small words, slower, like in Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, when Laertes is told that his sister drowns, his line, he says, oh, and where? And I remember in the movie, the guy just said it so slow and beautifully that I was like, oh. So, and then I've seen other things where short syllable words, saying them faster. So it's, I think sometimes just finding the rhythm, and if Shakespeare's rhythm could go either way, I think that's half the adventure.
Lest you think that Aaron is a stickler for tradition, however, we talked about what it was like to see plays done well that had interesting changes to them.
So if they had done the play, it wouldn't have mattered, you know, if it was all women or what. It's just, and that's what I really don't like seeing, is when people do a concept and then they totally forget the play. And it did not work. So, and on the good side, a friend of mine just did the history plays a couple of years ago. They did the whole, all eight. Oh, and it was so fantastic. And a friend of mine, she played Bolingbroke. And then later she played York, and her performance of York was the first time that I'd seen it done that I didn't feel like York was instantly the bad guy. All of a sudden, I was listening to her and I was like, well, York has a point. And yet she didn't lose any of the strength or power of York. She, and so, and, you know, and it didn't matter that York is a guy. the way she performed it, I just saw this character and his or her point of view. And they didn't do any of the gender stuff. You know, when they'd say he, they didn't make her look like a guy. And none of that bothered me because the honesty of it was just really impactful. And all of a sudden I was like, wait, York isn't the bad guy. And so I really enjoyed that. So sometimes, none of that matters when they focus on the play. So, yeah, because it doesn't serve. Then people look at it and they go, oh, I guess they shouldn't change genders because it's bad. But I've seen a lot of gender switching in Shakespeare. And when it's done well, it never bothers me. You don't even think about it. So I think the movie Julie Taymor is coming out with in December of The Tempest, I thought that was a kind of bold, but I like her choice. So that's the thing. It's like, if you have a good actor, it doesn't matter. And so I was like, okay, Harold Mirren, I like her. So
then I thought I should check in on what he was up to.
Right now, yeah, I'm actually, today I was working on Act 4, Scene 6 and Scene 7, which would be the end of Act 4. And then we'll go into Act 5, which would be two shows. So there's three shows left for Hamlet. So.
And it turns out that Aaron's reasons for doing his podcast, Chop Bard, are very similar to mine for doing Craftlit.
One of the things I found with podcasts in general is you'll find one that you like and you think, but how long is it going to be around? You know, is this going to fold up? And there's been shows that I really liked and then they disappear. Or there was a Shakespeare podcast that I was like, well, I want to get into that. And then I would look, you know, they'd have six shows 4 years ago. And I was like, oh, you know, you don't want to invest in anything that you don't think is going to be around. So I thought, well, maybe I should give two shows to let people know that I intend to. I don't know if I'm going to go through all of the plays because I just can't see going through Henry VIII. I saw a production of it live and I just thought, no, I think that's the one of the things why I started with Romeo and Juliet. One of the things that motivates me for the podcast in general is I would see these ideas that people would have of Shakespeare. And I'd think, one, it was either a boring idea or it was what was wrong. And it was I started realizing, well, this is why people don't like it, because they haven't been told either the truth about it or they haven't been told an interesting possibility. And an interesting thing for me doing the show is when, as an actor, you usually focus on your role and you see the play from that perspective. But doing it this way, because I was wondering about that. It's like, well, when I get to Juliet, you know, how am I going to handle that? But I found looking at it as a director from an audience perspective, I had a much broader sense of the play. And suddenly Juliet wasn't, oh, how am I going to read a woman? It was, here's this person that becomes a universal, like men could look at this and identify with her. And so it suddenly became really easy to identify, because it's not like when you're playing Romeo, you're looking at Juliet very differently. But when you're looking at all the people and getting into their heads, so I think that helped. I have a couple people interested. Well, I had that, well, a friend of mine, Kimberly Tuttle, came and read for Juliet. I think it's with the nurse when she's waiting. It's been a while ago, but I think it's the speech about when she's waiting for the nurse. But I'm trying to get her to come back and read some Gertrude, because the speech where Gertrude talks about Ophelia drowning is such a beautiful speech. So I was like, oh, you have to come and read this. So hopefully she'll come in the future and read some more stuff, because it is nice to get the interactive and hearing all that.
And then I asked him about some funny things he had done with audio for the naughty bits in Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. Oh, no. I've not done that as much in Hamlet. I know in Romeo and Juliet, a couple characters, I would tweak the thing. But it's I'm finding it's weird. In Hamlet, the show feels a little different, but I think it's just the play reflects. In Hamlet, I'm keeping it as fun and all that, but it just seems like sometimes there's just to find what Hamlet is as a play is half the battle. With all the resources, it's like, wait, how is it possible we even have this play today? The more I've researched it, I'm like, this is impossible that any of this got through. So Romeo and Juliet was a little easier in that respect, because there's an actual play, but Hamlet seems like anything we have today has just been Frankenstein together. So, it's a mess. I mean, with between the quartos and actually, I kind of always understood quartos and folios and had this vague knowledge of why that was important. But on Hamlet researching, unfortunately, I think I have a greater understanding of all those and how they work and sort of Renaissance printing practices. And I think it's on one of the shows where I mentioned they used to, when they'd print the folios or they'd print it, and if they found a mistake, they'd fix it, change it, but they wouldn't change any of the previous things printed. And they would read the pages as they came off the printer. And then if they found another mistake, they'd fix it and then continue printing. So you'd have these various levels of mistakes. So usually in a printing process, if you got the last copy, it was probably the most accurate. So even through like a first edition, if you had 50 books, they'd all be different. My head was spinning. I was like, what? I read that and I thought that can't be. So you have that. Plus you have the way they got all these was through people's memory or stage directions or stage manager notes. And then on top of that, editors fixing. So it's like, you know, who knows? Shakespeare's originals could be so different. Oh man, if I'd known half of what this play was about in school, it would have hooked me. And then I would have, you know, I think it leads to the other stuff.
If you start listening to Chop Bard at the beginning, which is Romeo and Juliet, you'll learn, as I did, that Aaron has a bit of a pet peeve when it comes to Baz Luhrmann's version of Romeo and Juliet starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. No slight on the two of them or any of the other actors who worked very hard, but Aaron had some issues with Baz Luhrmann, so I asked him some questions about the ending of the movie.
He has her waking up, and then he gives Romeo and Juliet this moment, which I remember when I did the play, I thought of that. I was like, oh, what if they had this moment? And the director at the time, he said, no. And later I realized it's worse if they don't have the moment, because then the audience is like, no, she's not dead. She's not dead. And Romeo never finding out that she's dead, I think it's harder on us. And I always think that if you have a choice between the actor having the emotion and the audience, I always say let the audience have it, because that's more important. And I see actors on stage like having this emotion, and I'm just sitting there going, oh wow, that's great. Look at you. But I think if the audience feels it, you've really done something there. So.
And then Aaron filled me in some background on when Chop Bard started.
Just about 2 years. I think I started in 2008. And you know, in the beginning, I loved it, and it was all very new. And you know, I'd do a show, and then like I'd work on the next show really hard. And the next month, I'd produce it, and then you know, 4 weeks would go by, and I'd do another one, and then the first five shows were rough because I was still finding my way, and you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? And I think at one point it clicked, and now pretty much every other week there's a show. And the last time I just slipped in an extra episode because I was like, well, I want to do this, you know, and I'll get really excited. And it's like, and it's nice that it caught on, because every now and then you get a scene, you're just like, oh, I don't want to talk about this scene. There's nothing. And you know, there is stuff, but I was surprised the scene with Ophelia where she goes mad and she's handing out the flowers. That scene always bored me. And I was like, oh God, I hate that scene. But as I read it and started looking at what the flowers potentially could mean, and Ophelia, and actually my friend Kim Tuttle, she has an amazing theory about Ophelia, about her madness and all that, that she's going to come on the show hopefully soon and talk about, because it was one of those theories that you just go, wow, I haven't heard that one, that you know, people say, oh, Ophelia just goes mad, but she really, I think it's called the baby bird syndrome, where you identify with someone. And her theory was that Ophelia is just identifying with all the men in her life and following their example. And she said, so her madness is just following Hamlet's example. And I always thought that was cool. And then when I started reading about the things that she does, like gender confusion, singing songs, I was like, well, those are all things that Hamlet does in his madness. So it was really interesting. All of a sudden I was like, oh, I see. And then there's people that do that in life. Now they identify with someone and they just, their whole life experience is through that other person. So she's going to hopefully elaborate more on it. But all of a sudden I was like, oh, wow, I think I understand Ophelia a little better.
Then Aaron and I kind of wandered off track and started talking about social obligation theater and the kinds of things that make us passionate about theater and good writing and things like this, and also kind of the things that we don't like so much.
Part of it is to blame. I had a professor who ingrained in us. He said it was a freshman in college, and he would pound into us. He'd say, if you go on stage and you do a bad performance, and he was deadly serious about this, and he still is. He said, if you go on stage and do a bad performance, people's souls are dying, and you're responsible for that. And we're all just sitting there looking at him going, really? And he said, you know, if you were a doctor and you performed surgery and didn't know what you were doing and someone died, people would make a fuss. And he said, but actors get away with bad performances. And he said, but you're killing their soul. He said, if they've never been to the theater and they see a bad show, they're never coming back. And he was convinced that their life would be less without that experience. And oh, man, he used to say all the time, an artless society is a dead society.
And of course, I had to ask him two final questions. The first, who is his favorite Hamlet? And the answer to that is David Tennant. David Tennant did a version for the BBC, and I lost the audio where Aaron described it, so I'm just passing that on to you. And second, I asked what kinds of podcasts he is currently jazzed by, and this was his answer.
There's a new one. They've only done 8 shows. It's called The Shakespeare Sound, and it's a couple, and he's an actor, but he mostly does humorous content or comment. But what I love what they do is they'll take they're into the sonnets, and they'll read it, and they do a blank read where it's just they read it, and then they do like an exploratory read where they elongate vowels and identify sounds and just sort of like chew on it, and then they do an interpretive read, and so you get each sonnet done in these 3 ways, and they explore it, and it's, you know, they're about 10-15 minutes, but it's just really nice hearing that. The work that goes into it and sitting there and it's just hearing people analyze Shakespeare from that. The thing that hooked me on it was in the first show, I think she said, put your dictionaries away because we're just here about the sound. Yeah, I liked that a lot.
And I'm sure you can tell that over time my audio was degrading as I was recording him. My computer died not too long after that. So I apologize for that, but I hope that this has intrigued you, because while Aaron does do some reading of the text during the course of his podcast, just to make sure that you know which scenes and what lines he's talking about, and occasionally, like he talked about, he'll have a friend come on and do some scene work with him. For the most part, it's him talking about the intricacies of the play, all of the information that we've lost over the many, many years since Shakespeare wrote, and what an enormous service he is doing. I know that we've talked before about potentially doing some Shakespeare on the show. And while I'm still, you know, very interested in Chip's King Lear, I think, was it Chip who was doing it? Oh, no, I can't remember. Anyway, it's an intriguing prospect. But now that I know that Chopbard is out there, I don't know. I'm kind of thinking it'd be a little bit of the Department of Redundancy Department. I think old Chopbard has the corner on this market, and I am so excited. I'm almost done with Romeo and Juliet and chomping at the bit to get going on Hamlet. And then in a couple weeks, he's going to announce his next, I think, 2 or 3 books, plays that he's going to be doing. Books. So go to inyourearshakespeare.com. Thank you again to Julie of Forgotten Classics Podcast for letting us know about that. I also wanted to announce, on the Julie front, she said she's pleased to be able to announce that she has gotten permission from Robert Alter and his agent to read his 2007 translation of the book of Genesis. This is huge. This is really, really cool. And, you know, leave it to Julie to be able to make this sucker work. I'm so excited. Because, as you know, I've mentioned it before, you have mentioned it in emails to me, the more you know of the Bible, the better off you are when it comes to literature, especially Old Testament stuff. This is getting brought up over and over again. You know, snake is rarely just a snake. So, yay, we're going to have a really good quality audio reading of a really good quality translation of the book of Genesis. coming very soon. I will give you a heads up when Julie starts recording that and releasing it to you, and that's very exciting. I also wanted to let you know that there is a poll up on the Craftlit show notes at craftlit.com for what to do for our next book. Now, you'll see there are three or four books there right now, plus a little note. If you leave a comment on the show notes for another book that is not listed in the poll, I will take that information from the comments and insert it into the poll so that it will become new. I'm not making any decision for months. I thought I had a decision made and then everything changed. So if you listen to this late, after it has been released, considerable amount of time after it's been released, go ahead and check and see if the poll is still there, because if you can see it, then it's still open. All right? Second thing, I have actually, it's like I said in the last couple of podcasts, you know, the end of August is a real slow time for everybody. All of a sudden, I can see everybody popping back up and the numbers are spiking again, and I'm getting emails. So I have a bunch of things to announce. One, Tricia sent us another blog post about visiting Lyme and a bunch of pictures of the Cobb. So I'm putting a link to that. So thank you, Tricia, for that. I'm also announcing, we've got a whole bunch of stuff. Yes, Susie up in Vancouver, BC. She has an Etsy shop that she has opened, and she said she has been selling hand-crocheted Mandy Rays from her friend Mandy's website, but she switched it over to Etsy. She has created a bunch of different goodies, little manta rays and little starfish, and she said she's originally from Birmingham, Alabama, but most recently lived on the Florida Gulf Coast for 8 years before moving to Vancouver. As a consequence, she knows plenty of people on the Gulf Coast who have been badly affected by the BP oil spill. And so the money from her sales at her Etsy shop, which is etsy.com/shop/twirlymama, all one word, T-W-I-R-L-Y, mama. And of course, there's a link in the show notes. There's a link to her shop because the money that she makes from that will be going to people who she knows down on the Gulf Coast who are suffering, which stinks. And we were watching more about, you know, rescuing birds and all of that stuff down there. And that's just... there are new follow buttons on the Craftlit show notes. These are buttons for you. If you find a show note or something about an episode that you really want to share, by clicking on the Stumble Upon button or the Twitter button or the Facebook button, instead of taking you to my page, it will take you to your page where you can share via your Twitter feed a link to the show notes or whatever it is that you happen to be looking at the time. That way, if there's something you really like, you can get the word out easily, and that helps me enormously. As you know, we've been morphing the kind of Craftlit universe into a larger and more inclusive whole that includes tutorial help and ebooks and the What Would Madame Defarge Knit book and all of these things. And one of the things I've been learning is search engine optimization. I am not going to bore you with this, but I am going to let you know something. If you are a blogger and there is something on another site that you particularly like, try as best you can not to say, I found a great example of a tutorial on how to knit toe-up socks here. Don't put the link on the word here. Put the link on the toe-up sock tutorial, because here's what search engines are doing now. They didn't used to do it this way, but now what they're doing is they're looking for quote-unquote quality links that link back to sites. So for example, if you link to the Yarn Harlot and you just do the, oh, I found something really funny on the Yarn Harlot site, here's the link, and you put the link around the word link, that's not going to do any damage to the Yarn Harlot. She's been around forever, and she's got tons of thousands of gazillions of links going back to her site. She's safe. But if you have a friend who just started a blog, and she's not getting a whole lot of traffic, and you're trying to help her out by posting something on your page. If you do the same thing and just put the link around the word link, you could actually be damaging her ability to get new readers via Google and Yahoo and all of these other aggregators, because they're looking for quality links from trusted sites. So if your site has been around for a little bit longer, you might be considered a trusted site, something that people link back to. It's like this, it's not being grandfathered in, but it's like being a legacy at a sorority or a fraternity, you know? It's, it may not be fair, but it's effective. And so what you want to do is think of the most descriptive way you can talk about whatever it is that you like, the toe-up sock thing, or a really great way to make homemade cheap yogurt, and then put the link around homemade cheap yogurt or something like that. That will make the search engines happy, and it will do more good for the people who you are interested in. So, on the Craftlit show notes, you'll notice in the left-hand sidebar, there's a little I Listen button, I Listen a Siakak, and there's code there. I have done the code work for you. If you steal that button and put it on your blog, it will link back to the show notes in a way that helps the show grow. So that's just a little something. I'm going to make more of those buttons to put on the library page as well, again, with a little steal my code information, so that those of you who are not listening in real time, you'll be able to grab those buttons as well. And let people know what you're listening to. I'm blown away by the number of people who are out there searching for free audiobooks and free audiobook podcasts and free classic literature in audio format, and also how to understand classic literature, and none of them are finding Craftlit. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, and none of them are finding Craftlit because I have completely ignored this side of the whole business of Craftlit. So, all those people out there who don't know that we exist, who aren't part of our happy little family, it's tragic. It's very sad. So I'm working on helping them find us and joining our team of brilliant literary scholars. That is the Craftlit family. What else? Oh, we went to the Museum of Miniatures in Tucson. If you ever come to Tucson, on Fort Lowell, Camp Lowell Road, there is a place called the Time Machine, and it is a giant, which is funny, room, a series of rooms that have nothing but miniatures, miniature dioramas, miniature dollhouses, miniature designs, miniature castles, miniature dragons, miniature everythings. Some of this stuff goes back to the 1700s. There are dollhouses from back then. Amazing stuff. So I'll see if I can find a link that shows you a little bit about what they do there, but it's wonderful. We also have a new blog to take a look at. Femke, who has been listening for a long time, she and I have emailed for a while now, and holy cow, I think, Femke, are you in Finland or Denmark? Now I'm confused and I don't have it on my notes. Anyway, she's wonderful, and she alerted me that she has started a new blog called 88 Novels at WordPress.com, which I'll provide a link to. But she also has been part of Crazy Aunt Pearl's read-along. I don't know if you knew about this. Lately, they've been reading Pride and Prejudice. They finished. And Crazy Aunt Pearl didn't like it quite so much. But she had some interesting reasons for why she didn't. And then the comments on that particular page are also fascinating. And again, sadly, none of the people who were on this blog post listened to Craftlit, but they had some very interesting things to say, as did you all. So I'm going to put the link up so that you can take a look at what Crazy Aunt Pearl and her listeners, or her readers, thought about Pride and Prejudice. It's very, very interesting. We also had a vote from Femke on doing The Awakening by Kate Chopin as one of our next books. So that is now up on the poll on the craftlit.com website. I also got an email out of the blue from a listener in Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico's in the house. Hello. Very exciting. We're just all over the place. Don't forget, the Lewis Creek sock pattern is still available for free at craftlit.com in the show notes in the upper left-hand sidebar, as well as links to The Golem. It's been a while. I did Agamemnon first for Monologues from My Husband for free download and full-length plays of his. And The Golem I've talked about before. I talked about his Golem when we did Frankenstein. It is one of my top two favorites of his plays. I liked Agamemnon because it's not the Agamemnon that I read when I was in college. And it, in many ways, because it's a bit modernized, I found it more disturbing, and also a lot more powerful. The Golem story has been told many, many times, and certainly Mary Shelley's Frankenstein resonates in the world of the Golem quite strongly. But also interestingly, yesterday when we were at Rosh Hashanah services, someone had a gallery opening of photographs from the Jewish graveyard in Prague. Now, if you've never been lucky enough to be there, it is shocking that this thing still exists, because it's right in the middle of the city. You know, the sidewalks on the other side of the street from the graveyard, they're apartment buildings. It looks like Prague. And yet in the middle of it, there's this enormous Jewish graveyard, and the Alt Nushul, the old new synagogue, is still there. And this is where Rabbi Lo was the rabbi in, 1600s. I think he died in 1609, 1610, something like that. And Meisel, who was the financier who kind of kept everything going, he's also buried in this graveyard. They are both characters in this play. And I know my husband did tons of research on both these two men, but also the emperor at the time, his assistants, what the Pope was doing, all sorts of stuff that was going on, as well as what was happening in scientific revolution at the time. So the play The Golem has a lot of historical accuracy, whether or not you believe a golem was actually created. And for those of you who don't know, a golem, well, it's an ancient story and it's an ancient idea, but a golem, qua golem, is a man who is made out of clay and brought to life and then protects the people who created him. And knowing whatever you might know about the history of Jews in Europe, there was some reason to be protected at a number of different points in history. And so that's what the play The Golem is about. So that is now available. There's a monologue for free, which is Rabbi Lo's daughter, Rachel, talking about when her mother died. That's the free monologue. And then the play is up and for sale as well. I am checking my notes to be sure I have covered all of the bits and pieces that I needed to cover. And yes, Twain. You didn't think I was ever going to get there, did you? Twain today. Liz wrote in to say, by the way, it isn't just clothes that are anachronistic. The entire story is. There were no castles, armored knights, or courtly traditions in the 6th century, which is absolutely true. Feudalism wasn't an English system. It came with the Normans in 1066. So the class structure that Twain is decrying wouldn't have existed in the real, quote-unquote, real Arthur's time. Twain, incidentally, lived during a big Gothic revival. Medieval elements were tremendously popular in literature, architecture, and decoration during the 19th century. And in fact, I am rereading a Tom Stoppard play called Arcadia before we go on our trip to London, Bath, and Wales, partially because we're going to be in England, but also because Tintern Abbey no longer looks like what it looked like when Wordsworth was there and writing his lines composed. As a consequence, it's kind of interesting to see how these Gothic and neo-Gothic and classic and neoclassical revivals affected the landscape as much as they did our perception of what happened back in the day, as it were. But today, oh, we have some fun stuff in Twain. They are leaving. They have left Morgan Le Fay's place. And they're back on the open road. And as you know, Twain likes that. And so he's very happy. And so is the boss. One of the things that you'll notice in this chapter is, as much as Twain has allowed the boss to harangue the church and missionaries and kind of this enforced obedience to this larger authority, you will notice again, in one of Twain's brilliant moments of turning things on its head, that the boss is doing exactly the same thing, but for a different reason. So keep your ears open for how he conscripts men to his will. And he also does a nice job with Sandy. Now, in chapter 19, which is the first chapter that you're going to hear today, Sandy starts telling a story again like she did before. She kind of picks up where she left off. And it's Mallory. She is actually reciting Mallory. And I know some people really think this chapter drags and is slow and miserable, but I think it's fascinating to hear Mallory juxtaposed to Twain. I also think it's fascinating to hear what a complete hash Twain allows the boss to make of chivalry. And he's completely ridiculous, absolutely completely ridiculous, and treats Sandy ridiculously as well. It's one of those moments that if this were really happening in front of you, you would either rip your hair out or try to rip his out, because he is just so over the top. And yet, in chapter 20, when he and Sandy get to her enchanted castle, he's not as big a pain. He changes. There's a soft spot for Sandy and how he looks at her and thinks about her after all this time. And so that's pretty much it. These are some fairly simple chapters, but there are some really interesting undercurrents of deep satire where Twain is making fun of people like the boss as the boss is making fun of the people that surround him. And it takes a master to do something like that. So, without any further yammering, I will give you our fabulous reader reading A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Knight Errantry as a Trade. Sandy and I were on the road again next morning, bright and early. It was so good to open up one's lungs and take in whole luscious barrels full of the blessed God's untainted, dew-fashioned, woodland-scented air once more, after suffocating body and mind for 2 days and nights in the moral and physical stenches of that intolerable old buzzard roost. I mean, for me. Of course, the place was all right and agreeable enough for Sandy, for she had been used to high life all her days. Poor girl, her jaws had had a wearisome rest now for a while, and I was expecting to get the consequences. I was right. But she had stood by me most helpfully in the castle, and had mightily supported and reinforced me with gigantic foolishnesses, which were worth more for the occasion than wisdom double their size. So I thought she had earned a right to work her mill for a while, if she wanted to, and I felt not a pang when she started it up.
"Now turn we unto Sir Marhaus, that rode with the damsel of 30 winter of age southward.
Are you going to see if you can work up another half-stretch on the trail of the cowboys, Sandy?"
"Even so, fair my lord."
"Go ahead, then. I won't interrupt this time, if I can help it. Begin over again. Start fair, and shake out all your reefs, and I will load my pipe and give good attention."
"Now turn we unto Sir Marhaus, that rode with a damsel of 30 winter of age southward. And so they came into a deep forest, and by fortune they were knighted, and rode along in a deep way, and at the last they came into a courtelage, where abode the Duke of South Marshes, and there they asked harbor. And on the morn the Duke sent unto Sir Marhaus, and bade him make him ready. And so Sir Marhaus arose and armed him, and there was a mass sung afore him, and he brake his fast, and so mounted on horseback in the court of the castle. There they should do the battle. So there was the Duke already on horseback, clean armed, and his 6 sons by him, and every each had a spear in his hand, and so they encountered, whereas the Duke and his 2 sons brake their spears upon him, but Sir Marhaus held up his spear and touched none of them. Then came the 4 sons by couples, and 2 of them brake their spears, and so did the other 2, and all this while Sir Marhaus touched them not. Then Sir Marhaus ran to the Duke, and smote him with his spear, that horse and man fell to the earth, and so he served his sons. And then Sir Marhaus alight down, and bade the Duke yield him, or else he would slay him. And then some of his sons recovered, and would have set upon Sir Marhaus. Then Sir Marhaus said to the Duke, "Cease thy sons, or else I will do the uttermost to you all." When the Duke saw he might not escape the death, he cried to his sons and charged them to yield them to Sir Marhaus. And they kneeled all down and put the pommels of their swords to the knight, and so he received them. And then they holp up their father, and so by their common assent promised unto Sir Marhaus never to be foes unto King Arthur. And thereupon, at Whitsuntide after, to come he and his sons and put them in the king's grace.
Footnote: the story is borrowed, language and all, from the Morte d'Arthur. M.T.
"Even so standeth the history, fair Sir Boss. Now ye shall wit that that very Duke and his six sons are they whom but few days past you also did overcome and send to Arthur's court."
"Why, Sandy, you can't mean it."
"And I speak not sooth. Let it be the worse for me."
"Well, well, well. Now who would ever have thought it? One whole duke and six dukelets. Why, Sandy, it was an elegant haul. Knight-errantry is a most chuckle-headed trade, and it is tedious hard work, too, but I begin to see that there is money in it, after all, if you have luck. Not that I would ever engage in it as a business, for I wouldn't. No sound and legitimate business can be established on a basis of speculation. A successful whirl in the knight-errantry line. Now, what is it when you blow away the nonsense and come down to the cold facts? It's just a corner in pork, that's all, and you can't make anything else out of it. You're rich, yes, suddenly rich, for about a day, maybe a week. Then somebody corners the market on you, and down goes your bucket shop. Ain't that so, Sandy?"
"Whethersoever it be that my mind miscarrieth, bewraying simple language in such sort that the words do seem to come endlong and overthwart."
"There's no use in beating about the bush and trying to get around it that way, Sandy. It's so, just as I say. I know it's so. And, moreover, when you come right down to the bedrock, knight-errantry is worse than pork. For whatever happens, the pork's left, and so somebody's benefited anyway. But when the market breaks in a knight-errantry world, and every knight in the pool passes in his checks, what have you got for assets? Just a rubbish pile of battered corpses and a barrel or two of busted hardware. Can you call those assets? Give me pork every time. Am I right?"
"Ah, peradventure, my head being distraught by the manifold matters whereunto the confusions of these but late adventured haps and fortunings whereby not I alone nor you alone, but every each of us, me seemeth—"
"No, it's not your head, Sandy. Your head's all right, as far as it goes. But you don't know business. That's where the trouble is. It unfits you to argue about business, and you're wrong to be always trying. However, that aside, it was a good haul anyway, and will breed a handsome crop of reputation in Arthur's court. And speaking of the cowboys, what a curious country this is for women and men that never get old. Now there's Morgan Le Fay, as fresh and young as a Vassar pullet, to all appearances, and here is this old Duke of the South Marches, still slashing away with sword and lance at his time of life, after raising such a family as he has raised. As I understand it, Sir Gawain killed seven of his sons, and still he had six left for Sir Marhaus and me to take into camp. And then there was that damsel of 60 winter of age, still excursioning around in her frosty bloom. How old are you, Sandy?" It was the first time I ever struck a still place in her. The mill had shut down for repairs, or something. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20. The Ogre's Castle. Between 6 and 9 we made 10 miles, which was plenty for a horse carrying triple, man, woman, and armor. Then we stopped for a long nooning under some trees by a limpid brook. Right so came by and by a knight riding, and as he drew near, he made dolorous moan, and by the words of it, I perceived that he was cursing and swearing. Yet nevertheless was I glad of his coming, for that I saw he bore a bulletin board, whereon in letters all of shining gold was writ, "Use Peterson's prophylactic toothbrush, all the go." I was glad of his coming, for even by this token I knew him for knight of mine. It was Sir Madoc de la Montaigne, a burly great fellow whose chief distinction was that he had come within an ace of sending Sir Lancelot down over his horsetail once. He was never long in a stranger's presence without finding some pretext or other to let out that great fact. But there was another fact of nearly the same size, which he never pushed upon anybody unasked, and yet never withheld when asked. That was that the reason he didn't quite succeed was that he was interrupted and sent down over horsetail himself. This innocent, vast lubber did not see any particular difference between the two facts. I liked him, for he was earnest in his work, and very valuable. And he was so fine to look at, with his broad, mailed shoulders, and the grand leonine set of his plumed head, and his big shield, with its quaint device of a gauntleted hand clutching a prophylactic toothbrush with motto, "Try, no you don't." This was a toothwash that I was introducing. He was a weary, he said, and indeed he looked it, but he would not alight. He said he was after the stove-polish man, and with this he broke out cursing and swearing anew. The bulletin boarder referred to was Sir Ossace of Surluse, a brave knight, and of considerable celebrity, on account of his having tried conclusions in a tournament once with no less a mogul than Sir Gaheris himself, although not successfully. He was of a light and laughing disposition, and to him nothing in this world was serious. It was for this reason that I had chosen him to work up a stove-polish sentiment. There were no stoves yet, and so there could be nothing serious about stove-polish. All that the agent needed to do was to deftly and by degrees prepare the public for the great change, and have them established in predilections toward neatness against the time when the stove should appear upon the stage. Sir Madoc was very bitter, and break out anew with cursings. He said he had cursed his soul to rags, and yet he would not get down from his horse, neither would he take any rest or listen to any comfort, until he should have found Sir Ossace and settled this account. It appeared, by what I could piece together of the unprofane fragments of his statement, that he had chanced upon Sir Ossace at dawn of the morning, and been told that if he would make a short cut across the fields and swamps and broken hills and glades, he could head off a company of travelers who would be rare customers for prophylactics and toothwash. With characteristic zeal, Sir Madoc had plunged away at once upon this quest, and after 3 hours of awful cross-lot riding, had overhauled his game. And behold, it was the five patriarchs that had been released from the dungeons the evening before. Poor old creatures! It was all of 20 years since any one of them had known what it was to be equipped with any remaining snag or remnant of a tooth. "Blank, blank, blank him!" said Sir Madoc. "And I do not stove-polish him, and I may find him, leave it to me. For never no knight that hight Ossace, or aught else, may do me this disservice, and bide on live, and I may find him, the which I have thereunto sworn a great oath this day." And with these words and others he lightly took his spear and gat him thence. In the middle of the afternoon we came upon one of those very patriarchs ourselves, in the edge of a poor village. He was basking in the love of relatives and friends whom he had not seen for 50 years, and about him and caressing him were also descendants of his own body, whom he had never seen at all till now. But to him these were all strangers. His memory was gone. His mind was stagnant. It seemed incredible that a man could outlast half a century shut up in a dark hole like a rat, but here were his old wife and some old comrades to testify to it. They could remember him as he was in the freshness and strength of his young manhood, when he kissed his child and delivered it to its mother's hand and went away into that long oblivion. The people at the castle could not tell within half a generation the length of time the man had been shut up there for his unrecorded and forgotten offense. But this old wife knew, and so did her old child, who stood there among her married sons and daughters, trying to realize a father who had been to her a name, a thought, a formless image, a tradition, all her life, and now was suddenly concreted into actual flesh and blood and set before her face. It was a curious situation. Yet it is not on that account that I have made room for it here, but on account of a thing which seemed to me still more curious, to wit, that this dreadful matter brought from these downtrodden people no outburst of rage against these oppressors. They had been heritors and subjects of cruelty and outrage so long that nothing could have startled them but a kindness. Yes, here was a curious revelation indeed of the depth to which this people had been sunk in slavery. Their entire being was reduced to a monotonous dead level of patience, resignation, dumb, uncomplaining acceptance of whatever might befall them in this life. Their very imagination was dead. When you can say that of a man, he has struck bottom, I reckon. There is no lower deep for him. I rather wished I had gone some other road. This was not the sort of experience for a statesman to encounter who was planning out a peaceful revolution in his mind. For it could not help bringing up the unget-aroundable fact that all gentle cant and philosophizing to the contrary notwithstanding, no people in the world ever did achieve their freedom by goody-goody talk and moral suasion, it being immutable law that all revolutions that will succeed must begin in blood, whatever may answer afterward. If history teaches anything, it teaches that. What this folk needed then was a reign of terror and a guillotine, and I was the wrong man for them. 2 days later, toward noon, Sandy began to show signs of excitement and feverish expectancy. She said we were approaching the Ogre's Castle. I was surprised into an uncomfortable shock. The object of our quest had gradually dropped out of my mind. This sudden resurrection of it made it seem quite a real and startling thing for a moment, and roused up in me a smart interest. Sandy's excitement increased every moment, and so did mine, for that sort of thing is catching. My heart got to thumping. You can't reason with your heart. It has its own laws, and thumps about things which the intellect scorns. Presently, when Sandy slid from the horse, motioned me to stop, and went creeping stealthily, with her head bent nearly to her knees, toward a row of bushes that bordered a declivity, the thumpings grew stronger and quicker, and they kept it up while she was gaining her ambush and getting her glimpse over the declivity, and also while I was creeping to her side on my knees. Her eyes were burning now, as she pointed with her finger and said in a panting whisper, "The castle! The castle! Lo, where it looms!" What a welcome disappointment I experienced. I said, "Castle? It is nothing but a pigsty with a wattled fence around it." She looked surprised and distressed. The animation faded out of her face, and during many moments she was lost in thought and silent. Then, "It was not enchanted aforetime," she said in a musing fashion, as if to herself. "And how strange is this marvel, and how awful, that to the one perception it is enchanted and dight in a base and shameful aspect, yet to the perception of the other it is not enchanted, hath suffered no change, but stands firm and stately still, girt with its moat and waving its banners in the blue air from its towers. And God shield us, how it pricks the heart to see again these gracious captives, and the sorrow deepened in their sweet faces. We have tarried along and are to blame." I saw my cue. The castle was enchanted to me, not to her. It would be wasted time to try to argue her out of her delusion. It couldn't be done. I must just humor it. So I said, "This is a common case, the enchanting of a thing to one eye and leaving it in its proper form to another. You have heard of it before, Sandy, though you haven't happened to experience it, but no harm is done. In fact, it is lucky the way it is. If these ladies were hogs to everybody and to themselves, it would be necessary to break the enchantment, and that might be impossible if one failed to find out the particular process of the enchantment. And hazardous, too, for in attempting a disenchantment without the true key, you are liable to err and turn your hogs into dogs, and the dogs into cats, and the cats into rats, and so on. And then, by reducing your materials to nothing, finally, or to an odorless gas, which you can't follow, which, of course, amounts to the same thing. But here, by good luck, no one's eyes but mine are under the enchantment, and so it is of no consequence to dissolve it. These ladies remain ladies to you, and to themselves, and to everybody else. And at the same time they will suffer in no way from my delusion, for when I know that an ostensible hog is a lady, that is enough for me. I know how to treat her."
"Thanks, oh, sweet my lord, thou talkest like an angel, and I know that thou wilt deliver them, for that thou art minded to great deeds, and art as strong a knight of your hands, and as brave to will and to do, as any that is on live."
"I will not leave a princess in the sty, Sandy.
Are those three yonder that, to my disordered eyes, are starveling swineherds? The ogres, are they changed also? It is most wonderful. Now I am fearful. For how canst thou strike with sure aim when five of their 9 cubits of stature are to 3 invisible? Ah, go warily, fair sir. This is a mightier emprise than I wend.
You be easy, Sandy. All I need to know is how much of an ogre is invisible. Then I know how to locate his vitals. Don't you be afraid. I will make short work of this bunco steerer. Stay where you are. I left Sandy kneeling there, corpse-faced, but plucky and hopeful, and rode down to the pigsty and struck up a trade with the swineherds. I won their gratitude by buying out all the hogs at the lump sum of 16 pennies, which was rather above latest quotations. I was just in time, for the church, the lord of the manor, and the rest of the tax-gatherers would have been along next day and swept off pretty much all of the stock, leaving the swineherds very short of hogs and Sandy out of princesses. But now the tax people could be paid in cash, and there would be a stake left besides. One of the men had 10 children, and he said that last year, when a priest came and of his 10 pigs took the fattest one for tithes, the wife burst out upon him and offered him a child and said, "Thou beast without bowels of mercy, why leave me my child, yet rob me of the wherewithal to feed it?" How curious! The same thing had happened in the Wales of my day under this same old established church, which was supposed by many to have changed its nature when it changed its disguise. I sent the 3 men away, and then opened the sty gate and beckoned Sandy to come, which she did, and not leisurely, but with the rush of a prairie fire. When I saw her fling herself upon those hogs, with tears of joy running down her cheeks, and strain them to her heart, and kiss them, and caress them, and call them reverently by grand princely names, I was ashamed of her, ashamed of the human race. We had to drive those hogs home 10 miles, and no ladies were ever more fickle-minded or contrary. They would stay in no road, no path. They broke out through the brush on all sides and flowed away in all directions, over rocks and hills and the roughest places they could find. And they must not be struck or roughly accosted. Sandy could not bear to see them treated in ways unbecoming their rank. The troublesomest old sow of the lot had to be called "My Lady" and "Your Highness," like the rest. It is annoying and difficult to scour around after hogs in armor. There was one small countess, with an iron ring in her snout and hardly any hair on her back, that was the devil for perversity. She gave me a race of an hour over all sorts of country, and then we were right where we had started from, having made not a rod of real progress. I seized her at last by the tail and brought her along squealing. When I overtook Sandy, she was horrified and said it was in the last degree indelicate to drag a countess by her train. We got the hogs home just at dark, most of them. The Princess Nerovens de Morganore was missing, and 2 of her ladies in waiting, namely Miss Angela Bohun and the Demoiselle Elaine de Courtemains, the former of these 2 being a young black sow with a white star in her forehead, and the latter a brown one with thin legs and a slight limp in the forward shank on the starboard side, a couple of the tryingest blisters to drive that I ever saw. Also among the missing were several mere baronesses, and I wanted them to stay missing. But no, all that sausage meat had to be found. So servants were sent out with torches to scour the woods and hills to that end. Of course, the whole drove was housed in the house, and great guns. Well, I never saw anything like it, nor ever heard anything like it, and never smelt anything like it. It was like an insurrection in a gasometer. End of chapter 20.
So once again, we have Twain using the situation that he has the boss in to make commentary on what slavery in the United States had done to the slaves. And I thought it was also interesting that he was going back to, I think it was Jefferson who said, the tree of liberty must be watered from time to time with the blood of its patriots, or something to that effect. I did not look that up. That just came to me right now. So someone will probably correct me, but the sentiment is certainly there. Although I thought it was interesting that instead of having Twain go to an American Revolution example, he went to the guillotine. I don't have any idea why he did that. if only, and the thing that comes to my mind right away is that he wanted to make the point as dramatically as he could. And while the American Revolution certainly spilled blood, it was not as bloody an insurrection as the French Revolution. And I suppose that makes his point better, that the boss really has no stomach for proposing or following through with that type of a revolution. So Sandy's ogre. Oh, Sandy. Yes, this is one of those chapters that is reminiscent of Don Quixote, where you have the enchantment that somebody can see the reality behind and somebody else can't, and that's very Don Quixote. But I would love to do Don Quixote sometime. It would take a lifetime to do Don Quixote. But anyway, I think that's it for Twain for today. Just a couple of things to remind you. The Golem and the free monologue are up and available on the craftlit.com website. If you click on CDs and Teas in the upper menu bar, you will come to a page. That's where anything that's for sale or for download is available. Also, I didn't mention this before, the tutoring site is up and running, and along with that, the link from the Craftlit show notes, the link that is in the right-hand sidebar that looks like a chalkboard and says writing help on it. If you Craftlit listeners click on that link, it will take you to a special Craftlit listeners only page at the tutoring site. There is a discount on all of the tutoring options or webinar options for how to get help for your writing. All of it's there. And I'll tell you, I did a bunch of research before starting this, and I was kind of disturbed. When I typed in essay help or writing help, things like that, I was getting sent to these websites where people were, well, they were paper mills. They were places where you could pay $15 a page, $25 a page, and someone would write a high school paper for you or a college paper for you. These people swore blind that they weren't plagiarizing, and all you had to do is, you know, deposit money in this account, and the next day you'd have an email with a paper attached to it. And I thought, Lord, that is so appalling. And then, you know, then there's the other sites. There's the cheater sites like cheater.com, where people upload a paper and then are given access to download a paper. And of course, I always reminded my students, you go to that site thinking that you can't write very well, but they have you upload a paper before you can download one. Everybody else did the same thing. That means you're downloading papers from lousy writers. Not such a good plan. But there's not a whole lot of individualized writing tutoring out there. So I felt really good about doing this. And of course, you are my larger online family and have stuck with me for years now, many of you. So I wanted to make sure that paid off for you in the long run. As far as services, I've split them up in a way that seemed logical at the time. But if there's something that you need that you don't see there, just email me and I'll figure it out and throw it up onto the website so that it is available to you. I do have an online classroom all ready to go. Life is good. And you know, it's middle school, high school. We could probably even do elementary school if the kids can type, and college age and adult business writing. These are all classes that I've been teaching either at high school or at the university. So that's all up there. And then the last note before I leave is this podcast will probably go live on September 11th. This is the 9th anniversary of that day, and I'll have a 9/11 post up on mamaoknits.com, and you know, my heart just goes out to everyone who has been missing part of their family for 9 years, whether it's the people whose family were on the plane that went down in Shanksville, or people who were lost at the Pentagon crash site, or the towers. I know lots is finally being done in New York to rebuild, and I'm very, very, very glad that it looks like the memorial at least will be in place for the 10-year anniversary. And on that note, I leave you. I hope you have a great week. I will too. And I'll talk to you soon. Take care. Have a good one. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And Knit Circus online magazine, offering 3 rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the summer issue at www.knitcircus.com. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.